Welcome to the Wonder Woman podcast, where we discuss a variety of subjects all pertaining to optimizing your physique, building strength, developing a strong mindset, and tools to help you win at life. I'm Michelle McDonald, and I'm the founder of the Wonder Woman coaching team. We are a community of results-driven coaches and clients who believe that we can age like never before. Welcome to the Wonder Woman podcast. I am your host, as always, Michelle McDonald. And today I have a fantastic guest. I'm really excited to have her on. She is a brain specialist, a neurologist with an incredible pedigree of education, ongoing research, and also really taking a stand on social media, getting a lot of wonderful top information out there, distilling high-end research for the public. So I'd like to introduce my guest, Aisha Sherzai. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me, Michelle. It's wonderful to be here.
So you also have your own podcast, and you've got a ton of great content, including, guys, listen to this, recipes, foods that are going to help support your actual brain health. Do you want to tell us a little bit about your background? Because I got to share this with the audience. I just discovered that both Aisha and myself graduated from the Natural Gourmet Institute. I'd love to know what attracted you to go there.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's wonderful that you were there too. And I love it that we both share that passion for food. I suppose, you know, I was brought up in a family of doctors and, you know, highly achieved individuals, and medicine was, it was almost determined that I was going to go into medicine. And, you know, I did go into medicine, and quickly I realized, and especially going into neurology, and at the time that I was training at a wonderful institution, Loma Linda University, I did a combined preventive medicine and neurology residency program. And so I learned about the brain and brain diseases in general. But, you know, when you are in the field of neurology, you realize that a lot of the diseases come to you, or patients come into you at a time when the disease has progressed significantly and the treatments were minimal. They still are minimal, but there's really not much that one can do. For example, I'll just give you an example for strokes, right? When a stroke happens, it feels like it happened right then and there. But for the majority of patients, it's the pathology actually that starts, you know, decades earlier, and it builds and builds and builds and builds. For example, people have high blood pressure for a very long time, decades. They have high LDL cholesterol for a very long time. And then they have, you know, abnormalities in their metabolism, which results in damage to the arteries. And then boom, they start having a stroke, right? And by the time they come in with the stroke, obviously, there's a dedicated team to address it right away, make sure they get clot busting medications, make sure that they go to an intensive care unit. And our main, you know, education and training was focused on identification of strokes and the treatment of acute strokes and rehabilitation, so on and so forth. And I quickly realized that prevention was kind of lacking. Yes, it was there, but it was kind of, you know, like swept to the side. And having had some background in public health and imparting knowledge to individuals, I was like, it just doesn't really make any sense for us not to focus on prevention. So I became really passionate about it. The reason I went into preventive medicine was because of that. And I found myself talking about people a lot about modification of their diet based on the research that was written on it. And then when it came to diet, I also realized very quickly that you can't use medical jargon, and you have to really give people very easy things to do on a day-to-day basis. And guess what was the easiest thing to talk about? Food. Oh yeah, here's a beautiful recipe for a soup that you can have, and it's quick, it's 20 minutes, it's delicious, this is what you add to it, this is what you subtract to it. So I would do my neurological examinations rather quickly, and then we would just talk about recipes. And I got so ingrained into it that I realized that I didn't know enough recipes. I was copying and pasting recipes from the website and from different sources. And one day I realized, I was like, you know, I went to Columbia University in New York, and my husband is such an amazing guy, and he you know, he's also a neurologist dean. He kept the kids in California. I went to New York to spend 2 years there to train as a fellow. And I found out that, you know, that was a great opportunity for me to learn more about nutrition. So I signed myself up to a cooking school. I'd be in the ICU in the morning treating patients in the ICU at Presbyterian Hospital, Columbia University Neurological Institute. And at 5 p.m., I would take the train down to Natural Gourmet Institute, and I would start cutting onions and potatoes and get ready for learning more recipes. And I think that was one of the best things that I did for myself, you know, for satisfaction and fulfillment that I have good knowledge about food and recipes and healthy eating. And also for my patients, my repertoire for recipes just suddenly, you know, exploded. And I helped them significantly. I felt that I was more useful with that, you know, armamentarium with me.
I love that. A doctor who actually carved out time to go to culinary school so that she could serve people better with real practical information. I mean, recipes. It starts with food, right? And I'm really sure Amory Colvin would just be smiling down from heaven right now hearing this, because she, you know, is the founder of the Natural Gourmet Institute. I know I was attracted to going there because of her and all of her great work. And I still think of some of the things that she said now in the space of coaching women through transformation journeys. I remember we cooked a lot of beans and cut so many vegetables with such precision. Do you remember those tests we had to do? You know, you'd have to cut, you know, brunoise something exactly like a quarter of an inch or something like that. It was just wild.
Oh, yeah. They seem like it's torture at the time, but they're so useful. And I'm so glad I went through it.
Ditto. So glad. It's funny too, because, you know, when I was looking at going to culinary school myself, at first I thought, you know, I'll probably go to the American Culinary Institute. And then I was, you know, I'd been in yoga for 10 years. I hadn't started with bodybuilding yet. That didn't start till actually when I graduated and I was doing my stage. So I was in yoga, and I knew that for over two decades, and I was a bulimic in my youth. So I'd always been fascinated about food and nutrition. And luckily I'd stumbled in my youth across some really great books that in retrospect it was just a stroke of luck that I found them. And I decided to go to the Natural Gourmet Institute because I knew I didn't want to be a chef, but I wanted to know how to understand the alchemy of highly nutritious food. I wanted to understand what the options were and then how to prepare it so that people don't even know that what they're eating is healthy, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And for me too, I mean, the most important thing is not just food, you know, food not as a vehicle of satisfying you, but also that satisfaction should come with taste, with ease, keeping budget in mind, keeping socioeconomic status in mind, keeping people's cultures and traditions in mind, because food is not food. Food is your story of how you speak with yourself, how you speak about your mom and dad, your uncle, aunt, your grandma, grandpa. There's so much to it. There's so many layers of complexity when it comes to food. And I'm glad that, you know, we both found that in the Natural Gourmet Institute. Not a lot of schools have it, but we had that capacity in that institute.
I love it. And it's really topical now because in this space of healthcare, whether it's longevity, whether it's cognitive health, whether it's cardiovascular health, whether it's bone health, I mean, the list goes on, the menopause space. What I'm hearing in the literature and of course in all the medical experts that I'm so lucky enough to interview is that guess what? the dietary prescriptions, they all overlap almost to the point where they are the same, right? Fiber.
Yeah.
How important a variety of plant fibers are in your diet and how important it is to avoid these empty calories and overly processed foods and all of that stuff. I'd love to pick your brain. I know. So one thing I really want to mention to everyone is please, everyone's going to fall in love with what you have to say here today. And I want to point them right now to your website. You've got so much great information. You've got a ton of great podcasts. You have a ton of fabulous recipes that look amazing. I'd love to have a crack at them. They remind me of my old days. And so please follow up with going to the Brain Docs website. So it's www.thebraindocs.com, and it's the same on Instagram and it's the same on YouTube. So you guys keep it really easy for us. And there's a really great freebie, a really great downloadable PDF that kind of unpacks some very simple strategies that anyone can follow. And I love that. And there's something else that you guys have. It's an online platform called the Neuro Academy. And I think do you run regular challenges, or how do you structure the Neuro Academy?
Yes. Well, thank you so much, Michelle, for sharing that. One of the things that Dean and I are very excited about and we're very passionate about is dispersing evidence-based information about brain health to the communities, because as you know, you're in that space, the same space that I am. There's a lot of misinformation out there. And I think it's a responsibility for all of us not to just sit on the side and allow for this to happen. So we've quickly realized, based on our research, based on our clinical experience with patients and with communities especially, that change in behavior requires a community, and people should see themselves in that community, in a loving and an empowering community with easily available information where they can assimilate what they can and also understand what they cannot do. Sometimes it's important for us to identify our strengths and limitations in any realm. And so we created Neuro Academy to get together a group of empowered individuals with the goal of disseminating small quanta of information on a regular basis that people can bring them into their lives. There are a lot of health literate individuals out there, you know, and I think there's enough information about everything. I don't think there's any secrets or anything like that. But including that in your lifestyle is where people fall short of, right? Like, how do I change my dietary pattern when I have 4 kids to feed, for example? You know, a mother would say something like that. Or how do I do it when I have a job that is taking so much of my time with me? So modification of information, giving them palatable information, and doing it so lovingly with moderators and a team of people always available to answer their question is the goal. So thank you for sharing that. And yeah, we're very proud of Neuro Academy. We started with, I think it was 50 people, and now we're a 2,000 plus a community. And it's been probably one of the most gratifying experiences of my life to interact with individuals there.
All right. So that's the Neuro Academy, and they can find that on your website, right? The braindocs.com?
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, so neuroacademy.com. It's there.
It sounds like you and I have a similar program, but the accent is on something a little bit different, although the tools, and we're going to get into those a little bit, the tools are very, very similar. It's not rocket science, right? Achieving robust health isn't rocket science. Although I'm curious, I'm going to pick your brains. I have a hard time as a coach getting my clients to eat enough vegetables, even though I say you've got to hit 25 grams of fiber and aim for 5 grams of fiber per meal. And I give them a food list, like, this is a good place you can start with. You got your legumes and whole grains and all that stuff. Do you, maybe, I don't know. Do you have an easier time with that? Because I have a hard time, like, getting gals past 10 grams of fiber sometimes. It's just, it's hard.
It is. It is. We go into it with the understanding that, you know, progress over perfection, that small incremental steps of change is way more important than meeting each and every goal. Mm-hmm. And so with the help of our live cooking sessions every Friday, with the help of the cooking interest club where people are actually posting there, we have meal plans. We change things often
enough. I'm going to steal some of these ideas.
Say, for example, oh, absolutely. I mean, I would love for you to be a part of that community. And, you know, I can invite you to come, and, you know, so many people are going to benefit from what you're offering. At the end of the day, it's helping motivating people. So we have enough elements with the app, you know, kind of checking things off, like, okay, did you eat some greens today, with the recipes, with the meal plans, keeping budget in mind, keeping time in mind, keeping ease at mind. Like, for example, we created a meal plan that has less than 8 ingredients, you know. People don't want to have a full pantry. People just want to make things whatever's in front of them. And you just have to work with people's capacities, their strengths and limitations. And at the end of the day, you're right. It is hard to be perfectly there 100% of the time. But if it's easy, and if it's tasty, and if it's doable, and especially depending on where they live, I think slowly and gradually it becomes a habit. And we've seen that in our clinic and in our research where, you know, something that sticks, that gives them that sense of reward, where the dopamine hits, it becomes a small habit. And then you stack that with something else, and before you know it, it becomes a core habit over time.
I love that. Okay, so you've got cooking classes. We're going to have to think about how that's going to happen. And you've got gals posting their recipes. I love that. We just did a challenge at the turn of the New Year's that worked really well. And that's, again, the community aspect to it. So guys, if you're listening to this, maybe getting together with some of your gals and pushing each other to come up with, to find. I know a lot of my clients love this gal called Lily Eats and Tells, because we have that macro-based aspect of things, but there's, you know, probably dozens of other great places to get some great recipes from. But pushing each other, encouraging each other, supporting each other to come up with these recipes. Do you have some hacks that you use? Like for me, for example, is I say, listen, if you're going to have a salad or some soup or something, just throw like a couple of tablespoons, like 30 grams of easy to digest legume. And you're just, that's just going to pop your fiber up, plus all the other good things that are in those legumes. Do you have any kind of simple hacks to help? I guess they're not clients, right? You're people, subscribers.
Members, community.
Your members, yes. Your members.
I suppose you could call them hacks, although that word bothers me sometimes, because we're so ingrained with the idea as behavioral neurologists that, you know, good habits happen over time and you just have to make it a core behavior and then you move forward. But no, just to use that particular term and in the sense, you know, what are some easy things that people can do with the biggest bang for your buck, or with the highest yield, you know, like high yield activities? Absolutely. Let me tell you about some of them. So, you know, I have a great team that works with me. And one of the things that we realized would be really easy, we actually have a cooking course. So we have courses too. And in our cooking course, we've created things like batch cooking. So for example, how do you make your food easy to prepare? So we've actually created these base flavors like mirepoix, you know, have some mirepoix ready, which is made with onion, carrots, and celery. Partially cook them and just keep it in your freezer. And if you want to have soup, just 2 scoops of that along with whatever vegetable broth and vegetables or your protein in there, and you have an amazing soup. Or for example, a seed mix. I make this, you know, I have them prepare a seed mix that is made with hemp seeds, chia seeds, with some sesame and some herbs and spices, just to kind of give it like that zing and that jazz it up. And you can put that on your salad, and that increases your vitamin E consumption. You get your omega-3 fatty acids to a certain extent. You get so much good fats, which are important for your brain health. So something like that, or your spice mixes. And then also just really easy recipes that are just there in your fridge, so that you wouldn't have to order in something that is high calorie, that has bad fats in it, that you would just feel terrible about yourself right away. So I do have those kind of recipes and foods that are easily available in your refrigerator.
I love that. Okay. So that's, I'm going to, again, these are great ideas. This idea of, I was thinking to myself, because a lot of times when we do things, we don't think of what we're doing. But when we're in that role of sharing and helping to onboard somebody else, that's when you realize you're doing all of these things. For example, I love seeds, and I probably fell in love with seeds even before the Natural Gourmet Institute. It was this, I found this little book. It was written by a Jewish woman. She had these 4 huge kids. I can't remember the name of the book, but it was this unbelievably wonderful, thin little book focusing on food. Did you read that book? It was an amazing book. But she got me into seeds.
Wow. Amazing.
But so
amazing.
I have this drawer in my fridge that has like different nuts and seeds, and I just sprinkle them, you know, and chia seeds. I just sprinkle them onto things, and, you know, 5 grams here, 5 grams there, 10 grams here, and it adds up.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It really does make a difference. My goal has always been for people to be comfortable to be home cooks. And, you know, there's nothing wrong with just, you know, splurging at times and going out with your loved ones and having a great time. I truly enjoy going out with my family and friends to some good restaurant. But say, you know, like 90% of the time, if you're a good cook and you make amazing food at home, that's such an empowering thing, because you have control over things like the amount of sodium that's in your food, which is so important for brain health, or the amount of good fats, you know, extra virgin olive oil or avocado oil, and reducing saturated fats in your diet, or improving the content of your fiber. Those make a huge difference. And, you know, we all know that, you know, diet is such an important part and parcel of our health, brain health, especially our mental health. So why not just be good at that? And you don't have to be like an expert at that. With some tips and tricks, with knowing like the basis of cooking, like, for example, I'm going to harp on mirepoix or making sofritos or making the base flavors of a fantastic Indian dish? Or how is an Indian recipe different from a Thai recipe? What are some of the spice flavors that are different? Those make a huge difference. And you can actually create like a gourmet restaurant type meal for your family in like a matter of minutes. I think that's pretty empowering.
Hey guys, thanks for tuning in to another episode of the Wonder Woman podcast. You know, we don't make money from this podcast. Our mission is to get as much great information out there to the widest audience possible to help more people like you thrive at any age. You could really help us out by sharing this episode with a friend who needs to hear this, or share the link to your favorite episode in your stories or whatever social platform you use. Second, please leave a rating and review on ratethispodcast.com/Wonder Woman. You're not just showing your support for the show, you're also helping other women find us. And finally, don't forget to subscribe to our podcast so you don't miss any episodes. Thanks again for tuning in.
So on that note, do you have any favorite cookbooks or websites or Instagram accounts that you direct your members to? Because I think that's always maybe your top two. I know my gals love Lily Eats and Tales.
Oh yeah, no, that's a difficult question to answer because I have so many favorites. Well, on the internet, one lady that I absolutely love is Nisha Vora from Rainbow Plant Life. She has amazing recipes. Like, there are some people who know flavor, and I feel like she gets it. She does.
So that's
have
Rainbow
such a beautiful
Life. What is it?
Rainbow Plant Life.
Rainbow Plant Life. And I assume that there's going to be, it's all vegan or vegetarian.
It's mostly plant-based. Mm-hmm. But you know, she actually creates, the most important thing that she does is layering of flavors. And she does it in such a beautiful way that is easy for people to follow. Another favorite chef, or, you know, someone who's written multiple books is Yotam Ottolenghi he's in London and he's got multiple restaurants. And oh gosh, I have his book somewhere here. It's always around. Oh, I was actually making something from his book, but you know, he's got these beautiful books. My favorite one is Flavor, and there's another one called Plenty. I'm looking at them right now. He's got incredible flavors too. So for me, flavor and taste is very, very important. And I think these two people get it. Of course, there's so many others too that are on the internet. I kind of feel embarrassed not remembering their names right now. But those are the two that I usually go to as far as...
Okay, I'm not even going to remember. Oh, you've got to say that name again. And I'll get his name from you and make sure
Ottolenghi.
It goes into the... Ottolenghi.
Yeah, Ottolenghi. 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 He's so famous. Everybody.
Oh,
yeah,
gosh.
He's
okay.
On the internet, and
so is it
he writes for the Guardian every week. Plenty, like a lot.
A lot. Okay, Plenty. I thought there may be like a spoof off of Plenty. That could be good.
Yeah,
and Flavor.
The other book that he has is Flavor. Flavor. Yeah, yeah. He's an amazing chef.
Okay, so those are some great tips. I love that. Do you want to tell me about the Neuro 9 and why you focus on the Neuro 9 for cognitive health?
Sure. So the Neuro 9, the Neuro is essentially an acronym that Dean and I came up with, kind of self-serving because we're neurologists. But you know, when you are speaking in front of people and there's limited amount of time and people are just like, just tell me what to do, you know, just tell me what to do. And I'm not here for all the boring, you know, like the diatribe about the different sciences, although there are a lot of individuals who are very interested in nuance. So we've created these acronyms and like short checklists for people to remember. And so Neuro 9 was one of them. Neuro essentially stands for nutrition, E is for exercise, U is for unwind, R is for restorative sleep, and O is for optimizing cognitive activities. And these are five factors that have been studied extensively that have been proven to have an impact on brain health and general health. We always say if you've taken care of your brain, you've taken care of the rest of the body as well. For brain, it's a bit different because optimization, the O in neuro, is important. People need to keep their minds challenged on a regular basis to live a long and a cognitively healthy life. In any case, so that's the acronym. And, you know, in our book, we actually explain all of it. Neuro9 were 9 foods that have been proven to be good for brain health. And it was an easy way for people to remember to see if they can add it to their plates on a regular basis. And this, the Neuro9, there's actually more to it, but, you know, the 9 foods that are very healthy for brain health are green leafy vegetables. And we know that green leafy vegetables pack so many anti-inflammatory polyphenols, antioxidants that essentially fight inflammation in our brain and our body. And we know from different studies that when people consume it, they actually, their brain age seems to be much younger. They have lower risk of developing cognitive impairment later on in life and strokes later on in life as well. The next one is whole grains. You know, unfortunately, there's this vilification of complex carbohydrates in our society where you hear, you know, Instagrammers or so-called experts completely vilifying things like oatmeal. Like, how can you say oatmeal is bad? Oatmeal is amazing. Or things like quinoa or things like even whole wheat bread, you know, 100% whole wheat bread that is high in fiber and so many other whole grains that are incredibly healthy for people. And we know from different observational studies, epidemiological studies, and even randomized controlled trials when it comes to cerebrovascular diseases that people who eat whole grains actually do very well. So that's another one. The third one is legumes, you know, great sources of fiber, micronutrients, plant-based proteins that are low in LDL cholesterol or saturated fats that is high in complex carbohydrates and proteins are quite beneficial. As a matter of fact, when you look at the blue zones, which is, you know, not necessarily a scientific cohort, but it's an ecological overview of how people live when they eat certain foods, the core food factor in all of blue zones is beans. When you eat beans and lentils, you actually do really well. You have lower risk of diabetes. You have lower risk of being an overweight person. You have low risk of having high LDL cholesterol, so on and so forth. The next one is cruciferous vegetables, the fourth one. And that's broccoli, cauliflower, kale, Brussels sprouts. They have so many compounds like camphorol and sulforaphane that fights inflammation and antioxidants. The fifth one is tea. Something as simple as tea. Definitely green tea, which has EGCG or even black tea or any other herbal teas have, they pack a lot of anti-inflammatory compounds. And when people drink, say, a cup or two of tea, they actually do very well. Caffeine is, you know, questionable. It may not be good for people. Some people, especially if they have anxiety or some cardiovascular diseases, but we now know that, you know, caffeine found in tea and definitely in coffee can actually be really good for brain health. And people who drink, you know, up to 3 cups of coffee a day have lower risk of developing Alzheimer's disease later on. So that's one of them. I'm losing count. Michelle, help me out here. Okay, so that was 5. The 6th one was herbs and spices. You know, pound for pound, they have the highest amount of anti-inflammatory products and they're so good for you, especially turmeric. When we actually looked at different studies that looked at turmeric, it has specific types of compounds, and one of them is curcumin. Mm-hmm. Curcumin tends to cross the blood-brain barrier, and it has an affinity for amyloid beta protein. It's the bad protein that has been associated with Alzheimer's disease. So, you know, adding some turmeric or any other spices for that matter is good. Then we have seeds, which are great sources of good fats. And some of them have omega-3 fatty acids. Nuts, that's 8, right? Nuts are wonderful because that also has good fats, polyunsaturated fats. And let me see, what did I forget? Oh, berries. How can I forget berries?
Berries, yeah.
Berries, especially dark colored berries like blueberries or blackberries are phenomenal sources of polyphenols. So, you know, these are foods that if we include them in our dietary pattern, the chances of us kind of going wrong, fill yourself up with these.
Exactly.
The chances of going wrong and eating things that may be unhealthy is lower. So that's Neuro9.
Again, I go back to Amory Colben, the founder of the Natural Gourmet Institute, because that's literally like the menu of the culinary school, right? And again, it's not rocket science. It's what's old has become new again, and people are discovering all of this. I'm going to ask a couple of questions because, again, I know people are listening. They have questions. There is so much confusing information out there. And I know there's a lot more I want to cover in the short time I have with you. So in terms of, and I know you spoke about, I was listening to your beautiful interview with Kimberly Wilson, and you guys were talking about nuance. And my coaches think that that's my favorite word. Nuances and well, it depends.
Mine too.
That's how you have to be if you really love science.
Absolutely.
So it's this idea of understanding biases and understanding what is high quality research versus the stuff that's at the bottom of the pyramid in terms of relevancy, right? So like expert opinion, for example, versus an RCT. So when we hear these things from certain groups saying that legumes, for example, are carcinogenic or they're bad for you or that grains are bad for you, do you have anything that you can say about that or point people towards or help them to understand what the red flags might be around a statement like that maybe lacks a bit of nuance?
Yeah, I don't think there's a perfect formula for solving dishonesty in social media and in the website. I truly think that that's one of the biggest problems that we're facing as humanity, just the dishonesty and the lack of integrity when it comes to science and scientific thinking. And I think it's causing a lot of harm too. It's nothing new. You know, sometimes I love my husband. Dean is brilliant. And he says, well, you know, I get really flustered when I see things like that on Instagram, on social media. And he reminds me that this has been going on for centuries. You know, snake oil merchants have always been there. People trying to make a buck or two out of people's, you know, hopes or despair is something that's very, very common. So we will always have parties and individuals that may say, oh, I know something that none of these doctors know, that none of these scientists know. Did you know that, you know, X, Y, and Z? And it's always this shock value, like, oh, I know something that nobody else knows. Did you know that what you have been doing all of your life is wrong? Like eating bread is bad, or beans that you've been fed since you were a child are contributing to your disease. And, you know, it stops people on their tracks. And, you know, unfortunately, a lot of these people have either a PhD or an MD or an MS or a BA next to their name. And it's very difficult for people to understand who to believe. It's not the public's fault at all. The way I find solace, or the way I think we can resolve that, is for people who are truly connected to the science and to the work that is being done behind the scenes, writing papers and publishing and working with cohorts and understanding statistics and understanding empirical data and data communication, more importantly. I think the responsibility falls on them, on us, on all of us, you and me, Michelle, to be able to share that in a palatable way with our communities, and to let them know that it's very important that if someone says something that is completely outlandish, something like beans actually contribute to cancer and disease, you have to pause. You have to say why, and you have to ask for more data. And for people to actually be able to ask for more data without ever feeling intimidated by these individuals, and that comparing that with what we know already before moving forward. That's the only way that I see it being helpful. And we always say, I think it's important for us to master the simple things, master the things that we already know, rather than finding the shiny object or something that is, you know, completely outlandish, because the chances are that outlandish news is probably false. Or even if it is true, the evidence is so weak that it hasn't been made mainstream as of yet.
I love that. And I think too, You know, especially when it comes to lifestyle factors, it's always great to remember that. I'm going to quote Stan Efferding. He's a powerlifting guru thought leader in strength. And he said, you know, when around sleep versus cardio, he would say, don't step over a $100 bill to pick up a quarter. If you don't get your sleep, you know, don't get up early and miss your sleep to get your cardio in. Get that sleep, and it's that important. And so with lifestyle choices, you know, chasing that shiny and oftentimes expensive thing versus like the basics, get the basics down. Because when we talk about percentages of improvements, and I think about this when I see some of the stats, you know, this is, you know, it reduces your risk of this, or it increases your risk of this, but compared to how much a lifestyle change could decrease your risk or increase your health, they often pale in comparison. Mm-hmm. And that's something that, again, speaking of socioeconomics, the lifestyle stuff, a lot of times anyone can do, right?
Yeah. So absolutely. No, absolutely. I think it's important. It's also important. I think it's important for us to add this here is that just because somebody has an acronym next to their name, it doesn't make them an expert in that subject automatically. You have to challenge everyone. You have to challenge me. Don't even take my word for it. Just because I have an MD or a master's degree and a PhD. And I think I'm a perpetual student. I always tell Dean, I was like, you have more degrees than a thermostat. But I don't think that automatically, you know, should stop people to question us. You should question everyone. And just because someone has those acronyms doesn't mean that they are experts in the field. I'll give you an example. I'm a neurologist. I've been in school forever. I still am in school. I consider myself a pretty knowledgeable person when it comes to brain health, but I will never give myself the permission to speak something outside of my subspecialty even. Like, for example, my subspecialty is stroke and cognitive impairment. That's what I trained at. But when somebody asks me a question about neuromuscular diseases or epilepsy, the first thing I do is text my neuromuscular specialist friend or my best buddy who is an epilepsy surgeon or an epileptologist that is my colleague. I ask them. So if I am stopping myself before I can speak about the brain, which is my field, but it's a small little subspecialty, I don't think you should allow someone who is not a specialist in brain health to tell you what you need to do for your brain. You should definitely question everyone. And I think it's also safe for people not to get, you know, rely too much on social media for their health. I think it's best to talk to a nutritionist, a dietitian, a registered dietitian, your primary care physician for good information, supplemented with books and information. But when it comes to core decision making, go to an expert.
I love that. So going to an expert, and I think too, understanding, this is something that I'm actually putting together, just a small little pamphlet for my own clients. Just understanding the hierarchy of scientific evidence. I think that's just, it's so valuable to understand there is an actual hierarchy, and that, you know, things at the bottom of the pyramid cannot trump things at the top of the pyramid. And just so be careful of cherry picking those studies that were done back in 1987, and they had 12 people that they looked at, and the results said maybe and needs more research, and then there's no other that it sort of ends there, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And also acknowledge the true humility of science, because science essentially is a mechanism, and it completely is subject to change with new data. It changes. Sometimes people think changing your mind is a bad thing because you're not sure. The most beautiful thing is to change your mind as data comes along, to say, oh, you know what? I was wrong. Or, hey, I have more data. Now I'm better. Here's the new way of thinking about it. And like you were saying, as far as hierarchy is concerned, science will not give us 100% of all the answers. But I think it gives us enough direction, enough vector to say, most of the data point towards this direction. Yeah, there might be a few percentage of it that points to the other direction, but I'm going to go with where most of the data is pointing. And I think we'll make more progress that way.
Guys, I hope you love that as much as I did. Dr. Aisha brought some great information around the nutrition side of things that you can pretty much implement right now for your brain health. Make sure to download her ebook, The NeuroPlan Playbook. It's free, and start rethinking your grocery list. You can also download our Macros Mastery Cookbook for a ton of great recipes that will also help you hit your fitness goals. Tune in next week for episode 2, where we'll be looking at the impact of things like strength training for cognitive health and other top tips for taking care of that incredible organ, the human brain. Don't forget to check out the show notes. We've added links to everything we talked about today. See you next week.